Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Chapter 4. Returning to his boarding house, Seton undressed and went to bed, but not to sleep. He knew that he had seen what could very well become a workable space drive that afternoon. After an hour of trying to force himself to sleep, he gave up, went to his desk, and started to study. The more he studied, the more strongly convinced he became that this first thought was right. The thing could become a space drive. By breakfast time, he had the beginnings of a tentative theory roughed out, and also had gained some idea of the nature and magnitude of the obstacles to overcome. Arriving at the laboratory, he found that Scott had spread the news of his adventure, and his room was soon the center of interest. He described what he had seen and done to the impromptu assembly of scientists, and was starting in on the explanation he had deduced when he was interrupted by Ferdinand Scott. "Quick, Dr. Watson, the needle!" he exclaimed, seizing a huge pipette from a rack. He went through the motions of injecting its contents into Seton's arm. "It does sound like a combination of science fiction and Sherlock Holmes," one of the visitors remarked. "Nobody home, you mean?" Scott said, and a general chorus of friendly but skeptical jibes followed. "Wait a minute, you hide-bound dopes, and I'll show you," Seton snapped. He dipped a short piece of copper wire into his solution, and it did not turn brown. And when he touched it with his conductors, nothing happened. The group melted away. As they left, some of the men maintained a pitying silence, but Seton heard one half-smothered chuckle and several remarks about cracking under the strain. Bitterly humiliated at the failure of his demonstration, Seton scowled morosely at the offending wire. Now, why should the thing work twice yesterday and not even once today? He reviewed his theory and could find no flaw in it. Well, there must have been something going last night that wasn't going now, something capable of affecting ultra-fine structure. It had to be either in the room or very close by, and no ordinary generator or X-ray machine could possibly have had any effect. There was one possibility, only one. The machine in Duquesne's room next to his own, the machine he himself had, every once in a while, helped rebuild. It was not a cyclotron, not a betatron. In fact, it had as yet no official name. Unofficially, it was the what-citron, or the maybe-tron, or the it-ain't-citron, or any one of the many less descriptive and more profane titles which he, Duquesne, and other researchers used among themselves. It did not take up much room. It did not weigh 10,000 tons. It did not require 1,000,000 kilowatts of power. Nevertheless, it was, theoretically, capable of affecting superfine structure. But in the next room? Seton doubted it. However, there was nothing else. And it had been running the night before. Its glare was unique and unmistakable. Knowing that Duquesne would turn his machine on very shortly, Seton sat in suspense, staring at the wire. Suddenly, the subdued reflection of the familiar glare appeared on the wall outside his door, and simultaneously, the treated wire turned brown. Heaving a profound sigh of relief, Seton again touched the bit of metal with the wires from the Redeker cell. It disappeared instantaneously with a high, whining sound. Seton started for the door to call his neighbors in for another demonstration, but in mid-stride, changed his mind. He wouldn't tell anybody anything until he knew something about the thing himself. He had to find out what it was, what it did, how and why it did it, and how, or if, it could be controlled. And that meant time, apparatus, and above all, money. Money meant Crane, and Mart would be interested anyway. Seaton made a leave-out slip for the rest of the day and was soon piloting his motorcycle out Connecticut Avenue and into Crane's private drive. Swinging under the imposing porte-cochere, he jammed on his brakes and stopped in a shower of gravel, a perilous 2 inches from granite. He dashed up the steps and held his finger firmly against the bell button. The door was opened hastily by Crane's Japanese servant, whose face lit up on seeing the visitor. "Hello, Shiro. Is the Honorable Son of Heaven up yet?"
"Yes, sir, but he is at present in his bath."
"Well, tell him to snap it up, please. Tell him I've got a thing on the fire that'll break him right off at the ankles."
Bowing the guest to a chair in the library, Shiro hurried away. Returning shortly, he placed before Seaton the Post, the Herald, and a jar of Seaton's favorite brand of tobacco, and said with his unfailing bow, "Mr. Crane will appear in less than 1 moment, sir."
Seaton filled and lit his briar, and paced up and down the room, smoking furiously. In a short time, Crane came in. "Good morning, Dick." The men shook hands cordially. "Your message was slightly garbled in transmission. Something about a fire and ankles is all that came through. What fire, and whose ankles were or are about to be broken?"
Seaton repeated,
"Ah, yes, so I thought it must have been something like that. While I have breakfast, will you have lunch?"
"Thanks, Mart. I guess I will. I was too excited to eat much of anything this morning."
A table appeared, and the two men sat down at it. "I'll just bring it on you cold, I guess. Just what would you think of working with me on a widget to liberate and control the entire constituent energy of metallic copper? Not in little dribbles and drabbles like fission or fusion, but 100.00000% conversion. No radiation, no residue, no byproducts, which means no shielding or protection would be necessary, just pure and total conversion of matter to controllable energy."
Crane, who had a cup of coffee halfway to his mouth, stopped it in midair and stared at Seaton eye to eye. This, in Crane the imperturbable, betrayed more excitement than Seaton had ever seen him show.
He finished lifting the cup, sipped, and replaced the cup studiously, meticulously, in the exact center of its saucer.
"That would undoubtedly constitute the greatest technological advance the world has ever seen," he said finally. "But if you will excuse the question, how much of that is fact and how much fancy? That is, what portion have you actually done and what portion is more or less justified projection into the future?"
"About 1 to 99, maybe less," Seaton admitted.
"Well, I've hardly started. I don't blame you for gagging on her to bit. Everybody down at the lab thinks I'm nuttier than a fruitcake. Here's what actually happened." And he described the accident in full detail. "And here's the theory I've worked out so far to cover it," he went on to explain.
"That's the works," Seaton concluded tensely. "As clearly as I can put it, what do you think of it?"
"An extraordinary story, Dick."
"Really? Extraordinary.
I understand why the men at the laboratory thought as they did, especially after your demonstration failed. I would like to see it work myself before discussing further actions or procedures."
"Fine. Well, that suits me down to the ground. Get into your clothes. I'll take you down to the lab on my bike. If I don't show you enough to make your eyes stick out a foot, I'll eat that motorcycle clear down to the tires."
As soon as they arrived at the laboratory, Seaton assured himself that the Whatsitron was still running and arranged his demonstration. Crane remained silent, but watched closely every movement Seaton made.
"I take a piece of ordinary copper wire, so," Seaton began. "I dip it into this beaker of solution, thus." Note the marked change in its appearance.
I placed the wire upon this bench so, with the treated end pointing out of the window. No, toward the wall. I want to see the hole made. Very well, with the treated end pointing toward that brick wall. This is an ordinary 8-watt Redecker cell. When I touch these lead wires to the treated wire, now watch closely. The speed is supersonic, but you'll hear it, whether you see what happens or not. Ready?
Ready.
Crane riveted his gaze upon the wire. Seaton touched the wire with the Redecker leads, and it promptly, enthusiastically, disappeared. Turning to Crane, who was staring alternately at the new hole in the wall and at the spot where the wire had been, he cried exultantly, "Well, Doubting Thomas, how do you like them potatoes? Now, did that wire travel or did it not? Was there some kick to it or was there not?" Crane walked to the wall and examined the hole minutely. He explored it with his forefinger, then bending over, looked through it.
Well, he said, straightening up, "that hole is as real as the bricks of the wall, and you certainly did not make it by sleight of hand. If you can control that power, put it into a hull, harness it to the wheels of industry, you are offering me a partnership."
"Yes, I can't even afford to quit the service, to say nothing of setting up what we'll have to have for this job. Besides, working this out is going to be a lot more than a one-man job. It'll take all the brains both of us have got, and probably a nickel's worth besides, to lick it."
"Chuck, I accept, and thanks a lot for letting me in."
The two shook hands vigorously. Crane said the first thing to do, and it must be done with all possible speed, is to get unassailably clear title to that solution, which is, of course, government property. Now, how do you propose to going about that?
It's government property, technically, yes, but it was worthless after I had recovered the values, and ordinarily it would have been poured down the sink. I saved it just to satisfy my own curiosity as to what was in it. I'll just stick it in a paper bag and walk out with it, and if anybody asks any questions later, it simply went down the drain as it was supposed to. Not good enough. We must have clear title, signed, sealed, and delivered. Can it be done?
Well, I think so. Pretty sure of it. There'll be an auction in about an hour. They have one every Friday, and I can get this bottle of waste condemned easy enough. I can't imagine anybody bidding on it but us. I'll fly at it.
One other thing first. Will there be any difficulty about your resignation?
Not a chance. Seaton grinned mirthlessly. They all think I'm screwy. They'll be glad to get rid of me so easy.
All right. Go ahead. The solution first.
Check, Seaton said, and very shortly the bottle, sealed by the chief clerk, labeled item QX47R769BC, one bottle containing waste solution, was on its way to the auction room. Nor was there any more difficulty about his resignation from the rare metals laboratory. Gossip spreads rapidly. When the auctioneer reached the one-bottle lot, he looked at it in disgust. Why auction one bottle when he had been selling barrels of them? But it had an official number, and auctioned it must be.
"One bottle full of waste," he droned tonelessly. "Any bidders? If not, I'll throw it."
Seaton jumped forward and opened his mouth to yell, but was quelled by a sharp dig in the ribs.
"5 cents," he heard Crane's calm voice. 5 cent bid. Any more? Going.
Seaton gulped to steady his voice.
10 cents.
10 cents. Any more? Gone. An item QX47R769BC became the officially recorded personal property of Richard B. Seaton. Just as the transfer was completed, Scott caught sight of Seaton.
"Hello, nobody home," he called gaily. "Was that the famous solution of zero?
Wish we'd known it. We'd have had fun bidding you up.
Not too much, Ferdy. Seaton was calm now that the precious solution was definitely his own. This is a cash sale, you know, so it wouldn't have cost us much anyway.
That's true, too, Scott admitted nonchalantly enough. This poor government clerk is broke as usual, but who's the we? Mr. Scott, meet my friend, M. Reynolds Crane.
And as Scott's eyes opened in astonishment, he added, he doesn't think I'm ready for St. Elizabeth's yet.
It's the bunk, Mr. Crane, Scott said, twirling his right forefinger near his right ear. Dick used to be a good old wagon, but he done broke down. That's what you think.
Seaton took a half step forward, but checked himself even before Crane touched his elbow.
Wait a few weeks, Scotty, and see.
The two took a cab back to Crane's house, the bottle being far too valuable to risk on any motorcycle, where Crane poured out a little of the solution into a small vial, which he placed in his safe. He then put the large bottle, carefully packed, into his massive underground vault, remarking, "We'll take no chances at all with that."
"Right," Seaton agreed. "Well, let's get busy. The first thing to do is to hunt up a small laboratory that's for rent."
"Wrong. The organization of our company comes first."
"Suppose I should die before we solve the problem. I suggest something like this. Neither of us want to handle the company as such, so it will be a stock company capitalized at $1 million with 10,000 shares of stock. McQueen, who is handling my affairs at the bank, can be president, Winters his attorney, and Robinson his CPA secretary and treasurer. You and I will be superintendent and general manager. To make up seven directors, we could elect Mr. Vanneman and Shiro. As for the capital, I will put in $500,000, and you will put in your idea and your solution at a preliminary tentative value of $500,000. But Mart,
hold on, Dick, let me finish. They are worth much more than that, of course, and will be revalued later, but that will do for a start.
Well, hold on yourself for a minute. Now, why tie up all that cash when a few thousand bucks is all we'll need?
A few thousand.
Think a minute, Dick. How much testing equipment will you need?
How about salaries and wages?
How much of a spaceship can you build for $1 million and power plants run from $100 million up, convinced?
Well, maybe. Except, well, right at first, I thought, you will see that this is a very small start, the way it is now to call the meeting. He called McQueen, the president of the great trust company, in whose care the bulk of his fortune was. Seaton, listening to the brief conversation, realized as never before what power was wielded by his friend. In a surprisingly short time, the men were assembled in Crane's library. Crane called the meeting to order, outlined the nature and scope of the proposed corporation, and the Seaton Crane Company engineers began to come into being. After the visitors had gone, Seaton asked, "Do you know what kind of a rental agent to call to get hold of a laboratory?"
"Well, for a while at least, the best place for you to work is right here."
"Here? You don't want stuff like that loose around here, do you?"
"Yes. The reasons are, first, privacy. Second, convenience. We have much of the material and equipment you will need already on hand out in the hangar and the shops, and plenty of room to install anything new you may need. Third, no curiosity. The Cranes have been inventors, tinkerers, and mechanics so long that no planning board has ever been able to zone our shops out. And our nearest neighbors, and none are very near, as you know, since I own over 40 acres here, are so used to peculiar happenings that they no longer pay any attention to anything that goes on here."
"Fine, if that's the way you want it. It suits me down to the ground. Now let's get busy."
"Please join me next time. for another exciting chapter in The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies. Thank you.